The following talk was recorded at LibrePlanet 2021 Empowering Users, the annual conference on current issues in ethics, social justice, and technology from the Free Software Foundation. LibrePlanet is a live conference, and speakers often use slides and other visual tools to assist their presentation. You can see the videos of these talks at media.libreplanet.org or on the FSF PeerTube channel. LibrePlanet speakers do not represent the mission of the Free Software Foundation. We host speakers talking about their use of free software in different kinds of political and commercial work. The FSF supports their freedom, but does not take positions on any political issues other than those necessary to uphold the principles of free software. Like all the FSF's work on behalf of the grievance of all computer users, LibrePlanet is made possible by thousands of individuals. To keep our work going, please consider becoming an associate member via my.fsf.org/join or making a donation at my.fsf.org/donate. You can stay informed by subscribing to our newsletter, The Free Software Supporter, at fsf.org/fss, and for more information on LibrePlanet, you can visit libreplanet.org/conference.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to my LibrePlanet 2021 virtual talk, an information theoretic model of privacy and security metrics, or how I learned to stop worrying about password meters and love the dice. I'm Bill Buddington, and I work for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. So if you don't know us, who is the Electronic Frontier Foundation? Well, we're a digital rights nonprofit based in the San Francisco Bay Area. We comprise this mythical triforce of technologists who create projects like CertBot, if you might have used that one, which brings HTTPS to websites throughout the web. Lawyers who have worked on such historic cases as Bernstein versus the USA, Department of Justice, which has ruled that code is a protected form of free speech under the First Amendment, and activists who try to make a better legislative landscape, both internationally and in the US. We fight for encryption, privacy, and security on the internet. You can find us at EFF.org. So who am I and why should you listen to me? Well, I'm a senior staff technologist at the EFF's Threat Lab, which is a team within the EFF that fights to, for instance, eliminate stalkerware and expose government plots to infect users with malware. We do reverse engineering of malware. So EFF Threat Lab does a lot of important work. I'm also a digital security trainer, so I work with activists and lawyers and journalists across the world to make their digital security and privacy better. And I'm also a privacy and digital security auditor. So I've looked into the Ring doorbell app and found that it was packed with third-party trackers and reported that that was widely covered in the media. I worked on HTTPS Everywhere from 2015 to 2018 as the lead developer, as well as Cover Your Tracks, which I'll explain now. Cover Your Tracks can be found at coveryourtracks.eff.org and as a project that was formerly called Panopticlick. What it is aiming to do is to let users know how there are little bits of information that are left behind by their browsers, and when stitched together by remote sites and trackers, can lead to a unique identifier, even separate from if they have cookies enabled on their browser. So this uses different characteristics that are found in the browser, from web headers to JS derived properties, and it combines these characteristics, as I mentioned, stitches them together into a unique fingerprint of their browser. So it compares browsers' fingerprints that we derive from these properties against other browsers' fingerprints that we've seen previously. And in that way, we were able to tell how unique your browser is from all the other browsers that we've seen across the web. This is what it looks like. Cover Your Tracks got a recent new redesign from its former iteration, Panopticlick. And we tried to make it more approachable, more understandable, add more graphics and explainers along the way so that people, if you get a general sense of what cookies are, you can come to the site and learn what fingerprinting is as well. Here is a example of my browser's result. When I took the test, it appears to be unique amongst the X number of browsers that we've seen in the past 45 days. And it conveys 18.11 bits of identifying information. So that's a little confusing, and we'll get into what bits of information mean in a few moments. And if you scroll down on your results, you'll see individualized results such as, you know, I was talking about before, your fonts, for instance, which is derived via JavaScript. You can also get different information about, you know, say, all these different metric piece of information that your browser leaves behind. So web audio context fingerprinting, the content types that your browser accepts, those kind of little bits of information and how they lead to your fingerprint being generated. So fingerprinting is a result of these two methods of getting information about your browser. One is through JavaScript and the other is through your web headers. The JavaScript can be either something that is directly queryable by the remote website. Say, you know, a website wants to know what your CPU class is. It can just query navigator.cpu class and figure out what type of processor you have. There are other more complicated ways to get properties from JavaScript. For instance, font detection can be the list of fonts that you have installed can be derived, figured out from this method that you have a bit of text that's rendered into a span, an HTML span, and the CSS and JavaScript changes the font that span is rendered in very rapidly and sees that the span width changes. And if it changes, that means that font is in fact installed on your browser and it can add that to your fingerprint. So those are different types of JavaScript derived properties. There's also the list of headers that your browser delivers every time it visits a new website. So it'll, you know, say, here's my user agent. This is the browser that I'm coming in on. These are the different types of content that this browser accepts. These different types of things that help a website render content properly also help a remote website identify your browser amongst other browsers. So when we're talking about entropy, we're talking about a real solid mathematical quantity that will allow us to identify a person's identity uniquely. We also talk about surprisal, which is a quantity that measures how entropy changes when we learn a new fact about someone. So, you know, it's not just in the browser. We can take this generic equation and apply it to identifying a person. So this is surprisal is derived through delta S is the log base negative 2 of a fact being what we expect it to be. So for instance, or, you know, a fact being true or not, basically. So for instance, a star sign, surprisal of learning someone's star sign is a log base negative 2 of the possibility that their star sign is a Capricorn. Now, ignoring that there isn't an even distribution of birthdays of humans, we can kind of say that the probability of someone being a Capricorn is 1/12. So that gives us the fact that log base negative 2 of 1/12 is 3.58 bits of identifying information from learning that someone is a Capricorn. So the surprisal that we get by learning their star sign is 3.58 bits. We can also get some information about about them through their birthday. So say we learn that their birthday is on January 2nd. So the surprisal of learning about their birthday is log base negative 2 of 1 in 365. And that's about 8.51 bits. So that's kind of getting some more information. But ordinarily, if these were independent facts, say the first, you know, instead of star sign, we knew that that person's favorite color was blue, and that was 1/12 calculation. So we would learn that 3.58 bits from the favorite color being blue, and their birthday gets us more information that we can add those bits together because they're independent facts. But in this case, learning that someone is a Capricorn, if we already know that their birthday is on January 2nd, doesn't give us any more information. So we only have those 8.51 bits of information because they're not independent facts, they're entwined together. So surprisal is this kind of interesting quantity that we could use to get a solid statistic about how identifiable someone's browser is and someone's identity is. What's interesting here is that the possible states that a certain metric can be in does not equate to how many identifying bits that we can learn from that fact. So take cookies being disabled. If someone has cookies disabled in their browser, that's pretty rare. That's either a true or false when we store it. That's one bit of information when we store that in a database. But the fact that they have cookies disabled is a lot more than one bit because it's so rare that it leads us to learn a lot about their identity. Even though we can't learn because, you know, cookies being disabled is such a rare thing, we learn a lot about them. So, you know, if you have cookies enabled, that's such a common fact that we learn almost nothing about the identity of that person. So I have cookies enabled in Cover Your Tracks, that garners us only 0.13 bits of identifying information. There's an analog to identifying people in the real world here, which is green eyes. Having green eyes is incredibly rare. Say that there's, you know, only 10 possible eye colors in the world. So that'll, you know, be some bits of information, but we'll get much more information by learning that someone has green eyes because it's such a rare quality. Green eye color is such a rare characteristic that we learn a lot of identifying information about them just by knowing that. So this is kind of a typical email that I'll get on the panopticlick@eff.org email address. I kind of get this all the time, but it's indicative of how people get confused here. So supposing, the quote says, supposing I wanted to make my browser blend in as much as possible, what is a good source of the most common user agents? I'm having trouble finding good sources thus far. So this is an interesting question because this person is trying to make their browser look like the most common browser user agent without necessarily changing a lot of other information. What I think the takeaway here, or the lesson to be learned here, is that customization is not recommended because, say you have Safari on iOS, and it acts like Safari on iOS, and it sounds like Safari on iOS, but it has the Chrome Windows 10 user agent, which is the most common browser in the world, right? So there is a pool of users that look like Safari on iOS, and maybe that's only a million other users. But because you fit into that pool, it's big enough for you not to have an identifiable fingerprint because your browser, you know, ignoring the fact that cookies are a thing, your browser the fingerprint will look like a bunch of other browsers because, you know, of the fact that Safari on iOS has a pretty common fingerprint. But if you take this one metric and make it the most common metric, you actually fit somewhere in the middle and you're extremely identifiable because you have the only browser in the world that looks like Safari in every other way except for a user agent that's Chrome 10. So it becomes actually way more unique on than just saying you have Safari on iOS and leaving it as such. In an effort to become more common, you make yourself more unique. This is why customization is not recommended, right? You're not going to blend in. Don't try it. So in order for fingerprinting to work, for trackers, I mean, to work. It has to be unique enough for it to be identifiable to a single browser and not this pool of other browsers. And it has to be consistent enough to not change all the time so that they can actually use it as a real identifier. So Tor browser takes the anti-fingerprinting approach of making all of Tor browsers all the Tor browsers look almost exactly the same modulo the operating system. So if you're using Tor browser on Windows, you'll look like every other Tor browser on Windows. If you're using Tor browser on Linux, you'll look like every other Tor browser on Linux. And this way, it makes this wide disparate array of different browsers and different people's computers look like the same exact browser because it has the same exact fingerprint. And this is a really good technique for protecting yourself from fingerprinting. There's another technique that was found to be really effective too, and that's randomizing the fingerprint. So instead of breaking the property of it being unique enough for it to be your browser, making it random enough not to be a persistent identifier that follows you around. So this is a technique that's used by a lot of add-ons, like Canvas Defender, for instance, changes the Canvas fingerprint of your browser and thus the fingerprint overall of your browser, if that's used in the entropy, in the fingerprint calculation. And Brave Browser also uses this. And Brave Browser does it in a really particular, interesting way. So they randomize your fingerprint, but the randomization algorithm is based on the first party domain. So when you're reading all of the metrics, a lot of those metrics are randomized based on first party. So if Facebook is using, you know, Canvas fingerprint, or audio context fingerprint, or other different methods that your browser gives off, other different bits of information, then because of Brave's randomization logic in the browser, if it's loaded on example1.com, it'll look like one particular hash. But if Facebook's code, tracking code, is loaded on example2.com, it'll look like a very different hash. But Google's loading, you know, Google loaded on example1.com will look the same as Facebook loaded on example1.com, but it randomizes based on the first party, right? So there's no useful information that Facebook can get out of this because it's changing all the time. It's not able to track you across different sites. Not only is it changing modulo the first party domain that you visit, but it's also changing, if you close down your browser, reopen it, it'll change completely too in the next iteration. So in this way, you kind of have this randomization take place on every browser session. And it looks kind of like a scramble suit. If you've seen A Scanner Darkly, a 2006 movie, this is a depiction of a scramble suit that protects the identity of the speaker. And it looks a lot like that, where it's just kind of changing all the time, and it doesn't provide you with enough solid information on that person being the unique person that you're looking for, that persistent identifier. So the view of Brave from trackers is very effective, right? It's very effective at breaking trackers' ability to track users. In most cases, dumb trackers, it'll be like, "Hey, check out this weird trick. Trackers hate it," and it's extremely effective. Well, smart trackers can actually do something novel right here, right? They can actually kind of figure out that you're using randomization and at least use that as a fingerprinting metric in and of itself. It's not going to be as unique as, you know, your actual Canvas fingerprint is, because that's extremely unique, but at least it can use your Canvas fingerprinting result and pool that with all the other people that use that same randomization technique, right? So Brave is unable to prevent that, really. But Brave's outlook here is that it's okay if they know you're Brave, just as long as you're using Brave, just as long as they don't know that, you know, your browser is you and this is you following you all over time. So the goal is, you know, in both these instances, Tor Browser and Brave, and, you know, all sorts of different anti-tracking, anti-fingerprinting, to reduce the amount of usable information that trackers can gather on your browser, right? And what's interesting here is that you can, you know, take browser fingerprinting and extrapolate it to different forms of fingerprinting, right? To different forms of tracking. In, you know, the case of browser fingerprinting, it's based on browser characteristics. But you could also think about behavioral fingerprinting, right? Separate from the browser, what behaviors do we exhibit when we're using the browser that can be combined to identify particular users, maybe even across browsers? You know, cross-device tracking works this way. And likewise, what can be done in the browser to kind of mitigate some of the effectiveness of these, you know, user behavioral tracking methods? These are some of the considerations to account for. We're talking about behavioral fingerprinting. We might be talking about highlighting text while reading an article, like, oh, I highlight some text while I'm reading an article. That's, you know, something I do. That's, you know, a behavioral fingerprintable characteristic. Or typing speed and cadence when we're typing. That's also, you know, something that can be fingerprinted. Cursor movement, or, you know, you fiddle around with your cursor. Scroll pattern, say you scroll up a paragraph every time you read a news article. Or switching of tabs, knowing that, oh, I switch tabs in this kind of particular method, and things like that. Those are considerations, and entry calculation here is the same, only it's, you know, user highlights text while reading an article. But what's interesting here is that when we're talking about user behavior, human behavior, it's limited by these predefined parameters. You know, when we're trying to consider entropy in this case, and when we're considering user behavior, it misses a lot of the valuable information that might be between the lines. So a user highlights, you know, if we take the, you know, last highlighting text while reading an article. Well, that might be just highlighting text randomly, right? But most likely it has some pattern to it. Like a user highlights only the first word of a paragraph, or the user is, you know, usually their cursor is in the middle of a paragraph and they only highlight the middle text in the paragraph block, or, you know, every morning after they drink coffee, they're fidgety enough to highlight text, but they don't do it any other time. So these entropy considerations, like, unlike browser characteristics, they're not confined to discrete states. They're really open-ended and complex, as rich as human behavior itself, right? And by open-ended here, I mean that there could be a pattern that isn't just easily recognized. There could be a deeper pattern that we don't, you know, foresee or understand yet. So Stuart Kaufman talks about these different systems, different types of systems. He describes, you know, these in his book At Home in the Universe. He's talking about chaotic systems, which, if you say have a matrix of different states, that if you switch one, you know, light bulb in a light bulb matrix, it'll have cascade effects which change the entire system very quickly. And then there's things like ordered systems, which are very, you know, rigid and are not subject to change. And if you flip the state, you know, somewhere in the middle of this, light bulb matrix, that'll, you know, stay very localized and won't change very much. It'll be confined. But complexity emerges at the edge of chaotic systems, in between chaotic and ordered systems. And that's where the most interesting behavior emerges, most interesting to us as humans, most complex, in terms of analysis of those behaviors. And this allows us as humans to be really adaptable and resilient, adaptable to changes, and resilient enough to not just kind of fall apart at something unexpected. Human behaviors are really complex, right? It allows us to adapt and navigate to our environment, both our physical environment and our social or group environment, our friends, our neighbors, our tribe, and also our society in general at a broader scale. language group or our international context, things like that. So when making this shift or thinking about kind of human neurology in terms of entropy calculations in privacy metrics to human neurology and security and passwords, we have to take into consideration that complexity in the sense doesn't lend itself to good password choices. For cryptographic applications, we're trying to use passwords that actually have this property of strong randomness. It's necessary for us to have strong randomness that is not as confined and predictable as human behavior is, human password choices are, for instance. And in fact, NIST, who sets the standards for government in choosing passwords, actually recommends now that password complexity requirements on websites that, you know, you choose a exclamation point or whatever, will actually reduce complexity. We don't use, necessitating uppercase letters, symbols, etc. Reducing password complexity, both for the reasons of that it's not going to get you anything in terms of security, of real security, it's pseudo security, and because it's less memorable. The complexity makes it less memorable and increases the likelihood of password reuse. So, you think about password and human neurology, think about these typical passwords of troubadour ampersand 3, right? So this is an extremely cryptographically weak passphrase, but it also exhibits this extreme bias. Say someone is, has been in a poet in the past, right, or does poetry, then they're much more likely to choose the word troubadour than something else, right, or than if someone hasn't been a poet in the past. So there's these patterns that are kind of like unexpected that you might see through someone's password choice. And password meters on human input are just incredibly bad practice, right? So this is pure security theater. You must have at least one letter, one capital letter, at least one number, can't have any more than three same characters in a row, can't be the same as the account name, and must have at least eight characters. It sounds very, necessitating complexity, necessitating, but actually, if you think about it, Ocean's 11 in this case will be a perfectly valid password, perfectly allowed and would validate. So password meters like this, or password are just check boxes essentially that don't necessitate anything more than non-memorability of your password. And KeePass XC, which is a program that I use to store my passphrase in my password database, has a password meter that's trying to calculate the bits of entropy that a password that's entered by a human exhibits. What is really funny is that, in this case, possibly the most quoted phrase in the human language, to be or not to be, that is the question, is measured at 123.21 bits, which is, almost AES secure. This is, of course, not the case. This is an extremely much less secure passphrase than the password indicator would indicate, or password meter would indicate. The password meters intrinsically, or they basically have to apply intrinsic criteria to an extrinsic data set, right? Something that is internal to the state of that password meter has to be applied to something that they don't know about and can't know about. So in this simple example, the word question is measured as, log base 2 of 26 to the 8 bits, because, question has 8 letters, and the possibility of, each of those letters that's 26 to 26 different possibilities in the English language character set. So it's 26 to the 8 bits. And that's kind of what the simple example of only being confined to intrinsic criteria that is trying to measure this more complex pattern that it can envision, and you know, apply that to this extrinsic data set. And in fact, they also don't even try to attempt to determine the source of entropy, the fact that humans are extremely biased, right? I think War Machine is extremely objective here because he's the best Avenger. War Machine rocks with an X, all caps. So the fundamental principle here is that any entropy calculation that's run on an open system will necessarily fail because it can't accurately model the source of entropy and the data set available to that system because it's open-ended, because there's, it's ever changing and there's all these different things that are being introduced to the system that it can't possibly take into account. And this isn't just theoretical. This has extreme practical implications, right? Like any mismatch between pattern recognition of the meter and that of attacker generating passwords to attack a target, it automatically leads to enormous advantage of the attacker. This can include any personalized knowledge of the target, anything that they post on a website publicly or is on their Facebook, or anything that the attacker knows about that person personally because maybe they know them in real life. And this is actually accounted for by programs like CUPP, which is, I just got it actually. Which is a program that is able to generate an extremely personalized password list and apply that, and maybe in combination with more generalized password lists, a personal generated password list based on, the person's first name, last name, their nickname, their dog's name, what their first car was, this kind of information, and it just can be combined with a generalized password to make a much more robust password list about that person. So, personalized word lists are extremely common offensive security practice. What is interesting here is that password reuse is also extremely common, right? So that 65% of people reuse passwords across different sites, even though they know they shouldn't. They do it anyway because it's the most practical thing. You are going to expect it to know passwords across 50 different sites. But this, has extreme consequences too, because 81% of hacking related breaches are, in fact caused by compromised passwords and reused passwords. So, password reuse is an extremely common yet dangerous in terms of practical implication thing to have happen. So why leave the choice of good random passwords to chance? If you were an organization attempting to mandate good security for user accounts, generate random passphrases for your users. And I'll get into how you can generate random passphrases in a moment. If you're a site maintainer, there's a few different options, but it's a little bit more complicated. You can use a good password-based key differentiation function like scrypt, and that'll kind of save your users in case of database compromise. You can also use a combination of that and server-side rate limiting, which will help with brute force attempts and IP blocks. If you see a brute force happening, these in combination will protect users' account security, but it still won't help against password reuse of someone trying to get into an account based on their password being compromised on some other site. It won't you could also possibly do something like mandating universal second factor U2F. But that is a pretty kind of frustrating thing to mandate because everyone has to have a UTF token or, you know, app on, you know, whatever, you know, as a second factor. These are kind of frustrating, the possibility of, okay, if it's important for you to gain users to make it easy for your site to be, you know, accessible, these are kind of some pretty hard kind of balancing tests to apply. Or you can highly encourage a user accepting a randomly generated passphrase, but at least actually just have a fallback if they want to generate less, or if they have, you know, want to have a less secure passphrase, you can kind of allow that too. So that's some kind of balancing considerations to kind of take into effect. So when I'm talking about randomly generating passphrases, it could be something like random characters, like you'd see in a typical random or typical password generator in your password vault. You could also have something like a dice generated passphrase. So this is Diceware. This is method where we've cultivated at EFF a list of a large number of words, and we derive words from a throw of the dice. So the way this works is that you throw a set of dice or die. You have five, you know, you get like say 5, 6, 4, EFF one is one, and then two, and you line those numbers up, 5, 4, 5, 6, 4, 1, 2, and then you take the list that we prepare for you that maps that result to a specific word. And then you do this 4 or 5 times, and then you get a word, a set of words that is random enough to use as a master passphrase for your password vault or something else. You know, in this case, stonks. So the advantages of using Diceware are that it can be guaranteed secure. Well, you know, if you're using KeePassX like me, you need to at least know that, for instance, your DevuRandom is secure, and that wasn't the case in some instances. DevuRandom or DevRandom, if it's not seeded with enough entropy yet, at boot time can be an issue. But if you're actually throwing dice as your master passphrase, which is recommended, then that's at least secure. It can be memorable. Human brains are really good at forming stories about different, you know, words strung together. We can it plays to our neurology in a way that makes us more secure rather than less. And it's kind of fun doing this kind of throwing of dice and figuring out what your new passphrase is, right? The disadvantages of Diceware is that it's pretty Anglo-centric in that, there's an English word list, and maybe there's a few other word lists out there, but it's not available in very many languages. And the most attention has been paid to the English language word list that has been kind of cold for that, for profane words and stuff like that. Maybe it's not fun too. Maybe you don't enjoy doing it. But you can see then SecureDrop. SecureDrop uses this method of choosing random passphrases, a set of 7 random words for their users. And SecureDrop does this because it might be, SecureDrop is a web platform that is for leakers, right? And it might be someone who's leaking national security secrets, and security is of utmost importance. You want to be sure that your users are secure. So when they're, when they're generating an ID for a source of leaked material, they want to make sure that they're corresponding with a journalist. They log you with a very secure kind of code name. In this case, Diceware's entropy is bound by the words in a word list. So you have log base -2 of the words in a word list. So in our case, it's 7,776 words times the bits of your passphrase times that by the number of words. So for every word in the word list, log base -2 of words in word list is 12.92, and then you multiply that by the number of words that you use. So say it's five words, then you get a 64.6 bits of entropy for a passphrase, which is pretty good if you use that in combination with a key elongation function. But are they actually memorable? So in this case, four random words, actually they are pretty memorable. You can use correct horse battery staple in this XKCD comic as a way to see how memorable it can actually be. So, you know, random diceware trial, maybe you don't like all the diceware rules, or you don't like all the kind of generated passwords that come from diceware. So is it still secure if you discard most of them? Well, let's see. In a random trial of four rolls, we get baritone repeater mower unzip pretext. Maybe you don't like unzip pretext. Maybe that's weird, dicey, whatever. Viewless undead purify habitable theology. Purify, not a great word. Maybe I don't want to discard that. Jargon context woof acquainting bruising. Bruising is so violent. I don't want that passphrase. Okay, how about this one? Giblet issuing cattail hand grip immature. Well, okay, that's better. Maybe I'll choose that one, right? So that's one in four that I've chosen. So that does decrease my level of security because I'm discarding a lot of perfectly good passphrases. If I discard enough, I'll just, you know, wind up getting a very bad passphrase like the, right? But, you know, how bad is it? So if I discard, you know, it depends on how much you discard on average. So if you discard, you know, say like only one in two different passphrases, right? Then you cut the amount of viable passphrases on average in half. So that's, you know, one bit of entropy that you lose from, say, 64.6 bits of entropy in the five, you know, words calculation. So that'd be 63 instead of 64 bits. So yeah, it gets a little bit worse, but not that much, right? One in four, you lose 2 bits. One in eight, you lose 3 bits. And that becomes, you know, 61.6 bits of entropy. So really, it's not that bad to discard passphrases if you don't like them. I was wondering about this myself because, like, you know, I will find some passphrases more memorable than others, right? And so it actually turns out that you'll be perfectly fine if you discard a bunch of passphrases in diceware before landing on one which you think will be really good for you. So in conclusion, you know, password meters are free as in beer, and they also suck as in free beer. They're not giving you a good sense of the security of your passphrase. They lead you to think that your passphrase is insecure when it actually is, if it's a you know, password auto-generated from, you know, say KeePass XC or some other password vault. And it also leads you to think that you have a secure passphrase when you don't, right? They're failing in both aspects, password meters. So that's something to keep in mind. Password meters are really horrible and you shouldn't use them. Use diceware, maybe, if you're, you know, generating your master passphrase in a password vault, right? Or if you're a site administrator, generate some, you know, user passphrases. If you're serious about user account security, then just think of how you might incorporate, say, a password, diceware kind of password generator into your site, and to allow people to auto-generate their own passphrases like SecureDrop does. And then maybe give them a fallback if they don't like that, if they are not going to use your site, if they can't choose their super insecure passphrase, right? That's maybe a fallback, but that might be a practical application for increasing user security in contexts where you can't control that. So thank you very much. I'm not sure if there's time for questions, but thanks very much. You can email me if you have any questions, bill@eff.org. I'm happy to take them. And thanks, Libre Planet 2021 staff.